The Tom Woods Show, episode 1051.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're looking to get a leg up at work or start a side hustle, then check out Skillshare. Tom Woods Show listeners get a free month of unlimited access to all 17,000 classes. Sign up at Skillshare.com/Woods. That's Skillshare.com/Woods to start your free month of unlimited learning. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Hunter Lewis is back with us again. We've talked to him a couple of times in the past. He's the author of many books, including Where Keynes Went Wrong and Where Bernie Went Wrong. Hunter Lewis is co-founder of Cambridge Associates, a global investment firm, and he is the author of the volume we're going to be discussing today, which is Economics in Three Lessons and 100 Economic Laws, two works in one volume. Hunter Lewis, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
You sure do pump out a lot of stuff on economics. Very good. So the first half of this volume is Economics in Three Lessons, with a tip of the hat to Henry Hazlitt. Obviously, that's meant to be a bit provocative for those of us who were raised on Henry Hazlitt's book. Why three lessons?
Well, it's more than a tip of the hat. I mean, it's absolutely following in Henry Hazlitt's footsteps. The first lesson in my book is a recapitulation of his book, Economics in One Lesson. But then I just added two more sections, one about prices and one about crony capitalism, because I think it's so important that in addition to getting that core message of Hazlitt's about sustainability and how you've got to think for the long term and not just for one group but all groups and so on, that in addition, one realizes how critical prices are to the functioning of the economy, and how destructive crony capitalism is.
All right, well, let's not assume, as I might be tempted to, that everybody's already read Henry Hazlitt. Not everybody has. So what actually is the primary message of his book? Apart from all the policies that he talks about, the merits or demerits of, what's the core principle he's trying to convey?
Well, I think the core principle is simply that we have to think about the long run, not just the short run. We have to think about the effect of policies on all groups, not just one group. And, you know, it's interesting that the word sustainability was really not so current in his day, just as crony capitalism wasn't either. It was invented later. And yet, he really produced this sustainability concept, which is largely ignored by Keynesians who tout it in the environmental area continually. So the same people who are talking about sustainability in the environment ignore it in economics.
I found that interesting, that your use of the term sustainability in this book, because sustainability, of course, as we know, is typically used in ways that are meant to disparage the views that you and I hold, that if you want sustainability, then you need all kinds of top-down controls. So how do you think about that concept?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, sustainability is a very, very old idea. I mean, Epicurus really expressed it beautifully, that we have to think about the long-term consequences of everything we do. And the idea that somehow we'll achieve that better with more government control is, of course, completely fallacious, because what government normally gives us is unintended consequences. It's people acting on their own behalf, working in a market environment, competing and cooperating, they're much less likely to create unintended consequences than some government officials sitting in Washington deciding for everybody.
Let's go over to lesson number two and talk about the price system, which you've written about before. I actually think in my own experience, learning about the way the price system worked was actually the first step toward making me a libertarian, because when I realized what just the free flow of prices made possible in an uncoordinated way, in the sense that there's no dictator in charge, made me extrapolate from that to think, wow, if prices can bring about all these miracles and they're not imposed by anybody, they're just created by the spontaneous interactions of individuals, then maybe just the spontaneous interactions of individuals are sufficient for society. So I that to me was a central insight. So if you were to talk to a, let's say, a typical young person who supports Bernie Sanders, who's never thought about the price system before, never thought about how amazing it is that we can coordinate all the things that we coordinate without coercion, how would you give a précis about this to them?
Well, I think it's helpful to, you know, think of it as a free price system. I mean, you know, everybody talks about a free market system, but I think that confuses people. If we simply say, you know, we're trying to have free prices so that people can cooperate and compete together without interference, you know, that is, I think, more communicable to young people. I think they understand it better. They get it. Oh, yes, we don't really want price controls. We do want the freedom in the economy to set prices and for people to, you know, do that on their own. So it's very important to understand this concept. And meanwhile, I think also young people, when they begin to understand that the tragedy of the middle class being destroyed today and the poor doing so badly and doing worse and worse, really, is the source of the problem is government price controlling in one way or another. Price manipulating, price controlling, price fixing. And people just don't understand how all this works. They don't see it. I mean, take the medical system, for example. Almost nobody knows that medical prices, which are invisible to the public in general, are mostly set by a committee of the American Medical Association, which then, you know, gives those prices to the Medicare system, which is run by private insurance companies. Those private insurance companies then apply those prices to their own system. And so those prices really go throughout the economy. And in effect, we have controlled and manipulated medical prices. And that in turn leads to higher and higher prices, of course. But people just don't see this. It's invisible to them.
You have a section in that part of your book called Who Are the Bosses in a Free Price System? And again, I think this would run completely counter to what even just the average person with no axe to grind thinks.
That's right. I mean, I remember I was at a dinner once and the professor to my right and the professor to my left, and of course, they were both Keynesians or really more socialists, certainly progressives. And they were saying, well, capitalism is the system that favors the bosses. And socialism is the system that favors the workers. And I said, well, what about the consumers? Where do they fit into your picture? Because actually, capitalism or a free price system is run by the consumers. And the consumers includes all workers and others as well.
There is a quotation later in the book that you take from Howard Zinn talking about profits. Because, of course, we can calculate profits and losses thanks to having a price system. That helps us to navigate all the many, many billions of possibilities in terms of things we could produce and how we could produce them and what inputs and methods and locations and all that. Profits are made possible. The calculation of profits is made possible by the price system. And Zinn says that profits have distorted our economy completely because it just leads people to make whatever things tend to maximize profits. I think he said something like that. I mean, my breath is taken away by what a stupid remark that is. And I'm curious about your answer to that.
Well, of course, profits are an absolutely key part of the free price system because they provide the incentive for people to kind of try to drive prices, costs down and therefore prices down. Why is it that we can produce certain things that are not so government controlled, like computers and electronics and so on, you know, more and more cheaply? It's because there is the incentive to earn a profit by finding ways to do it more cheaply and to make a better product at the same time. So profits are absolutely essential. And of course, the signals that profits send are, again, sent by the consumers. The consumers are the bosses, and they're telling producers what they want, when they want it. And so the whole system would collapse without the profits. It's just part of the pricing.
I've heard people say, I don't want to have an economy based on profits. And I don't remember who it was who put it this way, but a kind of snarky response is, would you rather have an economy based on losses? Which I realize is actually not that snarky, because if you don't have an economy based on profits, that is exactly what you have. By definition, is you have an economy based on losses. You actually have a section in here called The Essential Role of Loss and Bankruptcy, which I'd like you to comment on, because that, again, helps us to show how the price system makes sure that what's being produced is what people want, and it's in the right quantities, and it's being produced as inexpensively as possible so as to be least wasteful of our resources. So what is the essential role of loss?
Well, I think it's more accurate really to call the profit system the loss and bankruptcy system, because I actually think that sort of the stick there is more powerful than the carrot in terms of modifying human behavior and getting the results you want. I mean, most new businesses fail, and even very profitable businesses, eventually their profits diminish, decline, and disappear. So actually, I mean, profits are only earned when there is a problem to be solved, and entrepreneurs go out and solve that problem, and they have an opportunity by doing so to earn a very high profit, but it doesn't last very long, and eventually other people come in and compete and do the same thing, and the profit disappears.
I want to talk about the third plank of your three lessons, which is crony capitalism. We know that this exists, but I think a lot of people think it's a minor factor. I mean, like maybe, I don't know, I can't remember, it was the Obama administration and green energy, but this seemed to be such a small-scale thing that it was hardly worth worrying about. So how would you counter that? Why is crony capitalism actually more serious than people think? I think they're not defining it broadly enough, is my opinion.
Well, first of all, most of it is largely invisible, you know, like the price manipulations that are so closely connected to it. For example, you mentioned the Obama Green Energy Program, but you know, you might remember there was that fiscal cliff bill in which Obama finally succeeded in raising taxes on the rich, so to speak. And, you know, that sounded fine to me. But on the other hand, in that same bill, he had giveaways to his corporate donors, which in aggregate were larger than any additional taxes he was going to get from the rich. So that bill did not increase revenue to the government, even in theory. It was just full of these giveaways to his corporate donors. And of course, the Green Energy Program is yet another example where if you analyze who got those green energy grants and loans and so on, more than two-thirds of them were people who were major donors to the Obama administration. And it's not just the Obama administration, of course. It was the Bush administration. It's the Trump administration. I mean, this goes on and on. But the whole thing works as a system because the government gives these price manipulations to special interests, and the special interests in turn give the government campaign contributions and other support, and it's all designed to help the special interests or help the government. It's not designed to help consumers, the economy, the voters.
All right, now I want to get to probably not all 100 economic laws, but some of the more fun and juicy ones, which we'll do after we thank our sponsor. Seems like every day there's something new to marvel about on the internet, and Skillshare is my latest one. I've been looking through this thing recently, and I cannot get over all the classes I myself would want to take. These are classes that'll make you more desirable as an employee, or better equip you to become a successful entrepreneur. With over 3 million members, and yes, more than 17,000 classes, Skillshare is the Netflix of online learning. You can take classes in graphic design, DSLR photography, social media marketing, digital illustration, and much more. And these are skills that will take you a long way. I myself am dying to crack into some of the courses in email marketing, social media marketing, SEO. I can always get better at these things, and I'm always interested in learning from people who know more than I do. Skillshare is the classic reminder that the internet is about more than cat videos. Join the millions of students already learning and growing their careers on Skillshare today with a one-month free trial for Tom Woods Show listeners. Head over to Skillshare.com/Woods. That's Skillshare.com/Woods. to start your free month of unlimited learning. All right, you've got 100 economic laws in here. Now, you put this together, it's really two books in one. Is there a reason you did it that way?
Yes. The first Half, which is a book in itself, The Economics in Three Lessons, is really designed to be an introduction to economics for young people. This whole book is really intended for young people. And then the second part, The 100 Economic Laws, is intended, although very short, to be much more comprehensive. So the first part is rather easygoing, and the second part takes a little more work.
Well, I actually really like the second part because I think it's really helpful summaries of a lot of important insights. Now, when we look at your 100 laws, we note that the initial, however many of them, are actually focused primarily on economic method and making sure that our economic method is right, because if the method is wrong, then the conclusions we're drawing are precarious at best. So what would be some fundamental pieces of advice you would give when it comes to studying economics correctly?
Well, the most important advice I would give would be to avoid economic courses in colleges. Because, and again, one of my motivations in doing this was to provide an alternative perspective for young people. You know, economics is one of the most popular majors because young people go to college and they think, well, I won't necessarily be a business major, but I don't want to be a history major. That'll be hard to get a job from. So therefore, I'll take economics. That sounds practical and at the same time intellectually challenging. And so many young people sign up for these courses. And then, of course, as you know, much of what's taught is irrelevant. It's, you know, Alfred Marshall supply-demand curves that don't have any reality. Or much of it, if not irrelevant, is simply wrong. I mean, for example, in every economics textbook you have today, you know, you see this idea that if new money is created and it goes in the economy, it comes in evenly, it affects all prices if it does everywhere. And that was refuted by David Hume in the 18th century, and yet today it's in the economic textbooks.
Your section on laws pertaining to the division of labor will be familiar to a lot of listeners of the show and students of Austrian economics, and really, frankly, students of any good economics at all. And so I actually don't want to dwell on them, even though I just want to convey to the audience that you will find laws pertaining to voluntary exchange, private ownership, diminishing returns, comparative advantage, these sorts of things that we're familiar with definitely have their place in here. What I want to focus on is the emphasis on other points that we might know but might not classify as a law. So I want to go on ahead to the laws of prices, even though we've already been talking about prices, just because there are so many insights in here. Yeah, let's see. We have a couple, like, for example, the one on demand. And you say, if we want to increase prices, for example, wages, the most effective way to do so is not to mandate it, but to increase demand. What do you mean by that?
Well, absolutely. There are so many fallacies. I mean, take price controls as another example of this, where, you know, people think that in order to get prices down, you simply mandate that prices will go down, whereas in fact, what you need to do is increase supply. And a good example of this is in the medical system again today. Right now, government laws and regulations prevent nurses from doing most of the things they could do, even though they're almost as well trained as doctors themselves, and yet they're not allowed to do it. There are four-year trained naturopathic doctors. They're not allowed to do all the things they could do. So the supply, chiropractors are not allowed to do all the things they could do. So the supply of medical services could be greatly increased if the government would allow it. And why doesn't the government allow it? Because, again, they are working together with the American Medical Association to prevent that kind of competition for medical doctors or MDs. So, you know, again, if you want lower prices, you need more supply.
The laws of profits is a section that I'm particularly interested in. The very first one you give is, if you want lower prices for ordinary people, do not try to abolish profits. The existence of profits tends to bring prices down. So what's the mechanism exactly by which profits tend to bring about lower prices?
Well, actually, what usually happens is that if there is a problem, you know, some entrepreneur sees a profit opportunity to solve the problem. And then as they solve the problem, they're making a lot of money. And so competition comes in. Other people want to do the same thing. And as they do, supply increases, and so on, and prices fall. And of course, the other reason the prices fall is that as you solve the problem, you become more efficient and more productive, and that enables prices to fall as well.
Another one of these is, if you want ordinary people to control the economic system, then profits are essential for that purpose as well. Now, we've already gotten to that a bit in the sense that if you want to earn profits, you darn well better produce what people want. And so in a way, those people are, if not literally in charge, well, their opinions are very, very much at the forefront of what producers are interested in obeying. And of course, this runs counter to the idea that profits somehow, again, put big business in charge, but big business has to cater to you if it's going to succeed. Now, the corollary to that, though, from their point of view, might be, but big business can manipulate our desires. It can make us want the latest widget or the latest gadget, and therefore we are still very much in thrall to them. But I think the response to that is, if it were really that easy to just manipulate our desires, there'd be no need to do market research on products, and who knows how many billions of dollars are spent on that. You wouldn't need to do any research. Just produce the product anyway and bamboozle everybody into buying it. I think that criticism fails completely. Is that the way you see it?
Well, yes. And in addition, if it were so easy to manipulate the consumer and to bamboozle him or her, then why do all these big businesses go to the government and try to get protection from competition? You know, why are they so involved in trying to get special deals with the government for protection?
Yeah, they shouldn't need it, first of all. It shouldn't be necessary. All they have to do is run a commercial, and we're going to go out like zombies and buy whatever it is. Now, I'm interested in this one, patience. Go ahead.
I just want to add that, in fact, the whole purpose of the crony capitalist system is to evade the discipline of the consumer, is to evade consumer control.
Yeah, and the state is all too happy to oblige. Now, you have a principle here. You say patience, in parentheses, if you are unwilling to think very long term, even beyond your lifespan, you will not be able to realize the full fruits of the profit system. That's a very tantalizing principle. Can you elaborate on it?
Yes. And of course, it's closely related to the incredible power of compound interest. You know, people, one of the most fundamental things that students in economics who are starting out ought to be taught is how incredibly powerful that is. You earn 10% a year. Let's say you grow 10% a year. All right. Well, it takes you 7 years to double your sales. And if you begin with a small base, that doesn't add up to much. But then if you do it again and again and again, pretty soon you get to phenomenal numbers. I mean, this is why in another book of mine, you know, I pointed out that if you had just started with $10 a few thousand years ago and compounded at a really relatively modest rate, like 3%, let's say, you know, you'd have 10 times a larger global GDP than we have today, which shows that we've had almost no growth for most of human history. So once this principle of compounding was discovered and practiced beginning in the 18th century, that's enabled the economy to grow and people to escape poverty and so on.
I want to move ahead to the laws of economic equality and inequality, which is a topic that I think is being discussed a lot more today than it was in Hazlitt's day. And in particular here, in fact, I really actually would like to spend a little time on this. You start off, the very first one of these is, if our goal is economic equality, we must recognize that not all forms of economic equality are logically compatible. Ah, so there's a problem at the heart of the very idea. So what problem are you trying to identify here?
Well, I mean, you know, we all pretty much agree that equality of opportunity is a good idea. We want everybody to start the race at the same point and so on. And that's not easy because obviously if you have wealthy parents, you get an advantage and so on. But it's not realized that equality of opportunity and equality of outcome are logically incompatible. You can't have both at the same time. So obviously, if you mandate that everybody has the same result, then I don't have an opportunity to do anything different or be outstanding or accomplish anything.
Then you say that you talk about the problem of envy, and you say if our goal is a better economic outcome, envy will make it harder to achieve. Now, is that because if we're envious, we're going to envy yields very bad economic policies that will undermine capital accumulation, which undermines prosperity, or do you have something else in mind?
No, that's sort of the basic idea. I mean, again, we need entrepreneurs to solve economic problems, and if we're envious of their success, we're simply going to prevent them from succeeding in doing so.
Now, what do you mean when you talk about the inequality data? You say if we try to illuminate these matters with data, it takes a great deal of careful thought to ensure that it is not irrelevant or even misleading. With information, as with production or investment, the most critical issue is quality, not just quantity. So what problems are you identifying there in particular?
Well, for example, the government data on inequality is almost useless. I mean, it's not logical. It's badly put together. It's not accurate. Just to give you one example, I mean, the government does not include the refundable tax credits in the poverty calculations. I mean, that's just one example among many, many, many. Now, today, the government's own statistics say that, you know, since 1980 through 2014, the top 1% of earners have increased their earnings by 200%. While the bottom 50% have actually had a decline. So even the government data, which is very bad, shows that it's not working for most people.
There's so many of these, and I could pick any of them, but let's go on down, all the way down, even below. You've got sections on economic calculation, on government, on money. How about interest rates, given that most people hear interest rates and they just think boring, which is a shame because interest rates in some ways are, if not the whole thing, a pretty darn important ingredient in a smoothly functioning economy. So what can you tell us there?
Well, the two most important prices in the economy are the prices of money and the prices and interest rates, which are the price of credit. I mean, those are just incredibly important prices. They affect everything. And the role of the Federal Reserve and other central banks is incredibly important within the crony capitalist system. The Fed in the U.S. is in effect financing the entire crony capitalist system. And I just saw Janet Yellen just recently testified, and she said what a success their program had been since the crash. And her own staff have published articles saying that they estimated that everything the Fed did after the crash added 1/4 of 1% per year to the growth rate for the 4 years following. And yet she's testifying to Congress and saying, oh, it was a great success. And of course, I don't even believe the 1/4 of 1%. I think it actually held back the recovery.
Let me ask you a question about your own background, if I may. You co-founded Cambridge Associates?
Yes.
Okay. And that's a global investment firm. In what way did the kind of insights that you have in this book come to bear on your activities there? And like, in other words, were you observing some of this craziness and economic absurdity from your perch there, or are these entirely separate parts of your life?
Well, they're certainly not separate at all. Cambridge Associates is an investment firm. And I founded it with another partner in the mid-1970s. And so I've, seen a lot of ups and downs in the markets. I've seen a lot of the Federal Reserve over that time. I've closely observed it. But I must say that, the period since about 1996 has been fundamentally different. Ronald Reagan appointed Alan Greenspan as chairman of the Fed. And I think that was probably his worst single decision that he made. And the Greenspan Fed, started the current period of boom and bust. And then, of course, Bernanke made it far, far worse. And then Yellen has carried it on. So I think we're in a completely different period. Since 96, it's just been bubble and bust, bubble and bust. And, of course, I believe we're in another one.
All right. Let's say something quickly about the banking system, because you say, as law number 86, the way banking is currently set up guarantees its instability. Now, is that because, well, actually, I don't want to, I'll let you answer the question. Why is that the case?
Well, the way it's the case right now, of course, is that if everybody decided to go to their bank and demand their money back, the bank is supposed to provide it. They're legally obligated to do so, but they can't do it. And of course, that's a function of fractional reserve banking, which was a great mistake. And it was we almost avoided it. There were court cases back in the 19th century, both in England and the U.S. that were very close things, but we got fractional reserve banking as a result. Any bank is kind of technically bankrupt every day, in the sense that anybody, any bank could fail if everybody demanded their money back immediately. So that's one of the most fundamental problems in the economy, although it's not the only one.
But we have deposit insurance, and given that we're not likely to have a whole bunch of banks collapsing at once, can't the Fed just come in and resolve this and everybody's fine?
Well, deposit insurance makes people feel better, but what would actually happen if we had a repetition of 1932 and all the banks were failing and closing and the government had to make it good? Well, the government could only do that by printing a lot more money, and so a lot more money would flow into the economy, and then the value of the money that you got back from the bank wouldn't be worth as much. So it's kind of a false security.
What would be your preferred system? What would banking look like under the Hunter Lewis regime?
Well, I'd get rid of the fractional reserve banking. I wouldn't allow that. And I think, you know, that's the most important thing. But then in addition, ideally, the government wouldn't be in control of money. Money would just be like any other product. There would be private providers of that product. The good ones would survive, the bad ones would not. And I think that would just transform the whole economic system, and we'd have much more stability.
So what is preventing that kind of a reform? I mean, okay, vested interests. I'd like to know, what are the vested interests in the current system? And secondly, of course, scare tactics, right? Because the system you're advocating probably caused the Great Depression or something.
Well, I mean, if we, first of all, the present system enables the government to keep spending well beyond its means. So the government has a great incentive to keep it going. And the special interests have a great incentive to work with the government. Corporations, for example, have greatly benefited in their bottom line from the deficit spending the last 10 years, when it's been especially extremely bad. Most of that deficit spending has just flowed into corporate profits. And so everybody, all the big players have an incentive to keep the present system going, so long as it doesn't completely collapse.
All right. Well, again, of course, we have 100 of these laws. So I want to urge people, especially, as you say, younger folks, to just check out the book, because you're going to get, in a short space, digestible, an awful lot of economic insight packed into this. And then you can, at your leisure, you can read a whole lot of other books that elaborate on all these individual points. Now, is there any particular theme, though, that we didn't hit on that you feel like is a major piece of the puzzle and you would be hopping mad off after this call if we didn't get to it?
Not at all.
Oh, that's good. That's a compliment to me then. I take that. Okay, great. All right. Well, the book, once again, is Economics in Three Lessons and 100 Economics Laws, two works in one volume. We're going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1051, and go check that out. Hunter Lewis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we're done for the week, but I got a couple things I want you to know. First, this week's episode of Contra Krugman, which is episode 115, which may not be out precisely when I release this, but it'll certainly be out by the following day, is a great one. And we are just tearing into the guy, and a little bit on economics, but mainly on this wretched, wretched column he wrote just after Thanksgiving about how thankful he is for many things. And it turns out he's thankful for all terrible things. And it's just so bad. But boy, Bob and I were, if I may say so, we were in top form on this one. So if you're only listening sporadically to Contra Krugman, first of all, you're breaking my heart. But secondly, this one you want to listen to. So those of you who are new listeners of this show, Contra Krugman is what I call my sister podcast. I release it once a week. My co-host is Bob Murphy, and you can find out about it at ContraKrugman.com. We refute a Paul Krugman column every single week. Second thing I want to tell you is about, if you haven't gotten it yet, an ebook that I wrote. I wrote this whole thing myself. And in this sort of industry, when it comes to internet marketing and stuff, a lot of times people will buy the rights to a book, put their name on it, and sell it or give it away. And that's not what's happening here. I wrote every word of this book. I wrote a book about exactly what it is that I do. I have a chapter on podcasting. First of all, technically, how do you set up a podcast? It's annoying. If you don't know what you're doing, it's annoying. So I walk you through exactly how to do it. And then I even show you how you can actually make a living at it if you know what you're doing. So I got that. I got a chapter on how to self-publish a book. You may want to do that at some point, and you may not want to have to make all the mistakes. So I've made the mistakes, so you don't have to. So I went through, when I wrote my book, Real Descent, I wrote that book, which is my favorite of my books, by the way. I wrote that book using Amazon CreateSpace, and it did really well, and I really liked the process. And I earn a lot more from it than I would through a traditional publisher. I mean, there are pros and cons, and I go through those pros and cons in the chapter. But again, that may be something you want to know about. Or I've gotten pretty good at promoting affiliate products, like the Ron Paul curriculum has a great affiliate program. And if you're a libertarian, it can generate income for you on your website, if you have one. Or even through social media, you can earn affiliate commissions on that. So I have a chapter on affiliate marketing, and then on my email list that's associated with this ebook, I will sometimes send out an email and say, here are affiliate programs that are working really well for me, that people really go for, and they're converting, and here's how I'm getting people to use my link, and here are some bonuses that I give away to people. So I do a lot of strategizing about this, because I think you're leaving a lot of money on the table if you're not doing stuff like this. It's easy to do. I mean, if you're a libertarian, well, chances are you may know somebody, for example, who wants the Ron Paul curriculum. Well, you can earn money by offering it to them. You know, why not do it? Or my Liberty Classroom site, libertyclassroom.com, has an affiliate program. We give you 50% commissions on everything. It might as well. What could it possibly hurt to promote that? You get 50% commissions? I mean, I have a product there. The high-end product is in the hundreds of dollars. So anyway, I have a chapter on how to do stuff like that. So anyway, I got 5 chapters in this book. Costs you nothing. And as I say, I wrote every word of that. And you'll be able to tell, because it's obviously based on my own experiences with doing all these things myself. And it's a nice way to, you know, you can bring in a few extra bucks, or you could make a living at it, or you could make it into a side hustle, or it could be insurance against, you wrote an unguarded tweet and your boss fires you. Well, you got a little something on the side. So how do you get that ebook? Go over to pathstoincome.com. Because the book is called 5 Paths to an Online Income. I already gave you 3 of them. So it's pathstoincome.com, pathstoincome.com, and you'll get this beautiful book, beautifully laid out, beautiful cover, and it don't cost you nothing. So go grab that baby, and I'll see you next week. But listen to Contra Krugman. Don't forget, listen to Contra Krugman. All right, see you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.